Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Andy Mill, and he'll be answering your most important questions on a passion for tarpon. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Andy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Andy Mill about a passion for tarpon. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Andy, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Andy's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Andy's latest book, A Passion for Tarpon, as well as four fine art posters taken from some of the exquisite photographs in the book. And this is all courtesy of Wild River Press. And if you want to see more about what Wild River Press has to offer, go to www.wildriverpress.com. That's wildriverpress.com. And there you'll be able to get a copy of Andy's book and these posters as well, and also the other fine books that Wild River Press publishes. Well, here's how you can win Andy's book or one of these posters tonight. You must be one of the first people to answer the questions we ask at the end of the show. Questions will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills. Tonight our guest is Andy Mill. Andy was first known for his expertise on skis. As a resident of Aspen, Colorado since 1960, he has had every opportunity to sharpen his skills there. Andy skied on the U.S. ski team from 1971 to 1981, and during that time competed in two Olympics, the first in Innsbruck, Austria in 1976, and the second in Lake Placid, New York in 1980. He also skied in two world championships in St. Moritz, Switzerland in 1974 and Garmisch, Germany in 1978. Andy has worked with ESPN, NBC, and ABC since his retirement from skiing in 1981. He has worked exclusively since 1991 with CBS covering World Cup skiing and served as a color commentator for the 1992 Olympics in Albertville, France, in the 1994 Olympics in Lillehammer, Norway. He has hosted, wrote, or produced over 400 ski shows, including his own titled Ski with Andy Mill. In 1994, Andy was inducted into the Colorado Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. When Andy wasn't skiing, he was fly fishing. He wrote, hosted, and produced Sportsman's Journal, which included 81 saltwater fly fishing shows. His passion, of course, is tarpon, and he has won 11 tarpon tournaments, the most ever for one fly fisher. He is also the only angler to win a bonefish permit and tarpon tournament. Andy has served on the boards of the Aspen Education Foundation, the U.S. Olympic Educational Ski Foundation for the U.S. Ski Team, Aspen Winter Club Foundation, and the National Atlantic Salmon Fishing Federation. Well, Andy, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Wow, what an introduction.
Yeah. Well, you've done a lot, buddy. You've done a lot.
Oh, God. You know, when you start talking about all that kind of stuff, I think to myself, wow, what a road it's been, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the rough part is over. Now you get to do the fun stuff, right?
Well, hopefully.
I mean, you know, rough on the body is what I meant.
Oh, God. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, after all those years as a skier, I've sustained 10 knee operations. One of my knees was replaced in October, a broken neck, broken back, 3 broken arms. It just goes on. And, you know, I just feel lucky to be able to stand on the bow of the boat at this point, you know. But it was well worth it. It's been a good road for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about tarpon. And first of all, congratulations on the book you just published. I mean, this baby is literally hot off the press. And it's just an incredible book. 500 pages of tarpon and interviews and photographs that I just have to congratulate you on a job well done.
Well, thank you. It was, it was beyond what we have in our hands right now. Is something way beyond what I ever hoped or dreamt that I could actually do. I mean, I'm not a writer. At the outset, I didn't have a computer. I'd heard of email. And 4 years later, I've got 2 half index fingers because I didn't know how to type. I didn't know how to write. And meanwhile, what we have in our hands, I think, is a very substantial, multifaceted book. And I can't tell you how proud I am.
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as any library that needs to include tarpon, this is going to have to be on the shelf because there's a lot of history you covered in there as well. And a lot of this we obviously won't get into on the show tonight. But I just wanted to say thanks, hey, for your contribution to the world of tarpon, because I think it's a very good one. So,
well, you know, I appreciate you saying that. With all due respect to the world of tarpon, I think it's a great fishing book as well. It covers, you know, great stories. You know, obviously the people who know what tarpon are and people who have fished for them will be, you know, it's a perfect book for them. But I think people who like adventure and who like fishing in general will too be attracted to it because the stories are quite widespread. Even though they're, you know, focused on tarpon, it is fishing, and it is one of the great fish time for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, let's talk about tarpon. First of all, what originally attracted you to fly fish for tarpon? You grew up in Aspen with trout and so forth. How did you get hooked up with tarpon, and how's your relationship with the fish developed over the years?
Well, I think a lot of people, like myself, who are freshwater anglers, have heard of what this fish is, and they know that it swims in shallow water. You sight fish for them, very similar to, you know, dry fly fishing where you see the bite. A lot of times you won't see a trout, you know, you just know that he's down there, and all of a sudden you see the bite. But, you know, we've all seen the shows over the years of these big floating logs sliding down white sand, a prehistoric fish called a tarpon that eat chicken feathers. And I've always been fascinated by these big fish that swim in salt water. And I had never been fly fishing in salt before. And I was invited to fish on the show Fly Fishing the World with John Barrett. And I went to Belize, and that's where I saw my first tarpon in person. And, you know, throwing my fly at these fish sliding along this white sand and, you know, witnessing 2 fish come up and bite my fly, and just like everybody else, do a big trout strike and have the fish fall off my fly. And then when I got back to Florida, where I was living at the time, you know, part-time in conjunction with my home here in Aspen, I went out with Bob Branham and immediately got addicted to chasing tarpon, you know, because I think for a lot of us, and I think man's nature is to hunt. We were gathered, you know, the women took care of the camp, but we went out in the early years as cavemen and got the meat. So we men and women too love to hunt. So as much as it is fishing, it's hunting. It's all visual. So when you're standing on the bow of a boat and you see this 100-pound fish sliding along in 3 feet of water, and you can throw a chicken feather at it, and he opens this 5-gallon bucket of a mouth and just explodes on your fly, how more compelling can it be than that? And then when you hook them up, they go flying through the air and put holes in the ocean the size of cars. It's like, oh, my God, this is a sport that I want to be very much in, you know, have a very close relationship with.
It doesn't take much, does it?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's messed up many lives. Because for the next 25 years, all I could think about was trying to figure out how to refine this sport and catch more and be in the water as much as I could.
And then there's some, like some of the fly fishers that you've interviewed in your book, have been at it for more than that and are still trying to figure out what they're doing with their lives. So,
well, it's incredibly addictive, because I think when you take a look at what we do with a fly rod, you know, every aspect of fly fishing is very compelling in its own right. We have, you know, small midgets and fishing with 8X tippets and bamboo rods and little chalk streams, and then you've got the other end of the spectrum where you're trying to catch, you know, 300-pound marlin on fly rods and big bluefin tuna. But one of the great relationships that, and what is so special about tarpon fishing, is that when you throw a chicken feather, a fly at a tarpon, unlike a lot of other species, a lot of other fish, you don't communicate with the fish. With dry fly fishing, you try to imitate the perfect hatch. You may be able to twitch a terrestrial like a grasshopper, make it bump across the surf and entice the bite. Blue marlin fishing, where you're trolling a teaser and all of a sudden you get this thing crashing behind the boat, you yank the teaser out of the water, you throw a beer can at it, he's going to eat the beer can. But with tarpon, what makes it so special is not only the hunting and the visual, but once you get the fly in the right spot, you can speak to the fish. Once you put that fly in the right place, and when you see what the fish does when he sees your fly, then you make your next move and you're actually communicating with that fish. And the end result, you know, hopefully, is having that fish bite your fly.
Exactly.
And I think that with the aspect of the visual hunting aspect makes this sport, I think, you know, aspect of fishing that there is. And I've done it all. I've caught 800-pound blue marlin. I've traveled the world doing my saltwater fly fishing show. I've caught 85-pound giant trevally in the Seychelles. Big bonefish are great. Permit are great. You know, and I still love, you know, dry fly fishing here in the Roaring Fork Valley. But the pinnacle of what we do as being hunters and fishermen is tarpon fishing with a fly rod.
Yeah, I know from my experience, and you couldn't explain it. You can read it in a book. You can look at a picture. But until you're standing on the front of a boat and see a school of tarpon coming at you that are all, you know, 70 to 100-pound fish, and there might be 10 of them, you've never seen anything like that before in your life, especially as a freshwater fly fisher. So to me, there's just nothing like that. But it's really interesting, out of all the fishing you've done, that the tarpon has risen to the top in your mind, and I think that's really interesting. So,
well, I think, Roger, that simple, that one aspect, I mean, obviously we can see them swim in shallow water over white sand, and they look like floating logs, you know, approaching you. But I think being able to put the fly in the right place and being able to bump and slide and tweak your fly, talking to the fish, makes it that much more special, because the ultimate success for me is the bite. You have fooled that fish. And if you can imagine, the greatest correlation with what we do with tarpon fishing with a fly rod is the relationship with a cat and a piece of yarn. If you flip that piece of yarn over to a cat and if you get it too short, the cat's not going to react to it, or if you hit it in the head, it's going to run away. But if you put that yarn right in front of the cat and bump it, make it bounce, we all know this, that cat's going to reach out and grab that piece of yarn. Well, it's the same relationship with tarpon and a fly.
Right, right. I think the other interesting thing, and I think maybe this is what entices you, it surely does me, is that, you know, when you're fishing a trout stream, if the spot's not right, you move up downriver, you get in a different position. If it's a little windy, you could wade across, fish from the other side. But, you know, everything has to be just perfect to get that fly in front of the tarpon like you've just described. I mean, the boat has to be right, the wind has to be right, your cast has to be right, the fish have to be going in the right direction. I mean, it takes a lot of skill, in my mind, a lot of skill as a fly fisher, more so than any other thing that I've ever done. And so when it all comes together, it seems like a big point of achievement that you don't get elsewhere, in my mind.
Well, it's, you know, in that aspect, it's a very difficult sport. It's expensive. You have to travel to get there. And, you know, how many shots do you get a day? I mean, if the weather's right and the fish are swimming, you're going to only get so many shots. And how many times are you going to get the fly in the right place? It is very difficult. You know, you've got a lot of dynamics that have to fall into perfect alignment to get the shot, let alone to get the fish to bite your fly. And I think that's one of the most compelling aspect of it, is that it is so hard.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
It's not for everybody, but it really is something special.
Yeah. You participate, and you're well known for your participation in tarpon tournaments. What attracts you to the tournament? Is that your competitive nature, you know, going back to the skiing days? And what makes you so successful in those tournaments?
Well, I think it's kind of an interesting question because I have got no interest whatsoever in participating in a freshwater trout tournament, if you will, or the one fly out of Jackson Hole. For some reason, the tournaments in the Keys have really been a big part of that whole area because Isla Mirada is basically the capital of tarpon fishing in Florida. And what they did, the guides in the 60s, to get their anglers to come back into June, once they, at one point June was considered the off season, so everybody came in April, May, and then they left town. So they started these tournaments to get their anglers to come back and fish these tournaments. So it's a big deal there. It's like World Cup skiing in Europe. It's their number one sport every Sunday. In the entire country, all the countries of Europe are shut down to watch World Cup skiing. And the United States is not, you know, as important. Obviously, it is, though, but not nearly as it is over there. So tournament fishing in the Keys for bonefish, permit, and tarpon has really been a big deal for over 40 years. So when I started catching a lot of fish, and luckily I got involved with a very, you know, very good mentors, the best guides in the world. And when I started catching a lot of fish and I started getting pretty good at it, I pursued it and really kind of had a chance to study it. The only way to assess how good you really are is to compete against your peers and other anglers who are pursuing it as well. And I don't think I would have ever gotten involved had my mentor at the time, Harry Spear, not convinced me that I was good enough to compete in these tournaments and do well. And so I was very lucky as an Olympic skier to have a second chance in a career to do something at a pretty high level. And as an Olympic skier, I skied in, as you mentioned, two Olympics and two World Championships, but I never won. I never won the Olympic gold. I never won the World Championships. My best was sixth in the Olympics in 76. But here, as a saltwater fly fisherman, I had a second chance to do something at a pretty high level. So now, the age that I am, I've got my family, I was married, I had a chance to really focus and do it at a high level, at a professional level, as I had as an Olympic skier. But as an Olympic skier, you're, you know, in teens and early 20s, you're not as focused or as professional as you should be in a lot of situations, and as it was in my case. But as a saltwater fly fisherman, having this as my background, I was very fortunate to be able to really focus on really studying these fish. I had enough money to fish a lot, and I was fishing with the best in the business. So I had a chance to really refine not only my skills, but the sport as a whole. And so for the last 25 years, I think, you know, with what I've done with my guides and my fellow anglers, we've really raised the bar in a lot of ways and how to refine the techniques and the methodology to catch these fish at a very, you know, successful, consistent level.
Okay, so you mentioned one thing that makes, sounds like a difference is your focus. What other things in the tournament scheme of things makes you more successful as a fisherman?
Yeah, I think what happened, and I think the reason I was pretty good at the time and what I did was really try to, one, I fished a lot. And not everybody has a chance to fish 30 and 40 days a year to get ready for the tournaments. So I not only fished a lot, but I really tried to assess my tackle and the tippets and the shocks and the type of material I was using. The prime example is when I first got started in this 20 years ago, the smallest hook anyone was using was a 3-0 hook. And before my time, the hooks were like 5-0s. In the freshwater world, it's a big hook, unless you understand what, you know, number 1s through 12s and 28s, that's all freshwater terminology. But when you talk about 2 and 3-0s, it's a much larger hook. But when I really started being consistently good, fishing over very sensitive fish, I was downsizing my tackle. Instead of your typical 180-pound shock tippets, I started using fluorocarbon and dropping down to, say, 60-pound shock. And when you're catching 120-pound fish with 60-pound shock, you run the risk of that fish chafing through that shock. But I also went from, like, 3-0 hooks down to 1-0 hooks because in my methodology and trying to intercept the fish, a lot of people, when they see a fish floating in their direction, they throw the fly to the fish. And a very important analogy here is that you want that fly to intercept the fish. When he's swimming in the water column 3 feet below the surface, you want that fish to all of a sudden come upon your fly. So if you throw that fly to the fish, if you cast to the fish and the fish sees that fly hit the water, it is game over. You've got no chance. So I started really working on intercepting the fish better. I would throw a bigger lead slide the fly out there a little bit longer and slide it into position well before the fish was ever there. And with a little 1-0 hook, it would stay suspended a lot longer. It wouldn't sink as fast. So if I tried to do that with a 3-0, that hook and fly would be below the fish's level in the water by the time that fish got there. But by using a 1-0 hook and smaller and tying that fly with sparser material, I could get a bigger lead, get the fly into position, and so all of a sudden when that fish was in, you know, at my fly was all of a sudden there, and I could start the feeding process of that fish. So it was twofold. I think it was one, fishing a lot, downsizing my tackle, you know, as far as my, in longer leaders, you know, back then it was typically 9 to 12 foot leaders. I started fishing with 15 and 16 foot leaders. And my fly line, I started fishing a Cortland fly line, and the 9 foot tip of the fly line was all clear, an intermediate sinking fly line. So I had 9 feet of clear fly line plus 15 foot a leader. So I had 24 feet of clear before, you know, from the fly to the fly line, I had 24 feet of clear material. So it was more of a stealthy approach, more camouflage, if you will.
Right, right. Well, Andy, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about your experience at tournaments and catching trophy tarpon. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.kiene.com. That's www.kiene.com. Or call them at 800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Andy Mill about a passion for tarpon. If you'd like to ask Andy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Andy, before we jump back in, I wanted to ask you about what is going on in your fly fishing world now. And is tarpon still a big, I know the book has taken up a lot of your time in the past probably year or two, but what else is happening and what are you working on?
Well, the book actually took 4 years to write, so I was pretty busy with that. But, you know, with the tarpon, they swim basically, you know, April, May, June. And what I've done is 2 years ago, I kind of took a step back from the tournaments. It was taking up a lot of my time. They were expensive. And I've got three boys. My middle child, Nikki, is 16, and he's a passionate angler. So we shark fish a lot of the winter, and now he's fly fishing for tarpon. So I'm trying to teach him everything I know. So I've moved 16 feet backward. I went from the bow of the boat to the back of the boat. So I'm pushing my boat and teaching him how to fish. But professionally, beside the book, you know, being released, I signed a contract with Hardy out of England. The great English, you know, fly rods and reels, the Prince reels. I mean, I grew up with Hardy's. And they wanted to get involved with saltwater fly fishing. They had the Zane collection up until this last year. And so I signed a 3-year contract to help them redesign their saltwater rods and reels. And what we have right now is absolutely mind-boggling. You know, the cast, you've got a rod that not only has to cast the fly line but fight the fish. And we've come up with a great combination through our new resins that we have, and you're going to hear a lot about them this fall. And our new saltwater fly reel is beyond belief. So, you know, I've been focusing on, you know, working with them a lot. And other than that, just, you know, basically trying to, you know, keep the boat afloat, if you will, with three kids. And I've got a home here in Aspen. I love to elk hunt with my bow in the fall. And I've taken that on as passionately as I have tarpon and Olympic skiing. So, you know, my summers, late summers and falls are elk hunting out here, and then I spend my winters with my kids in Florida.
Is the new Hardy line that you're working on going to be at the Fly Fishing Retailer Show in September?
They're going to be there in, I think it's September 9th, I think the show is, yes. And, you know, just to make it brief, I was fishing with our new rods over the course of the winter. And I told them, I said, we need to make a lighter casting rod than what is typically out there right now, but we need to make it durable. And our new rods, we've got the new resin from NASA, and it's enabled us to make a lighter rod, but a rod that is almost virtually unbreakable. And testing the rod all winter, I was catching 15 to 30 black tip sharks a day throughout the winter months in West Palm. using straight 100-pound test and pulling as hard as I can pull on 100-pound, you know, black-tip sharks, which are a really great aggressive fish, and I have yet to break a rod. And then we kind of retweak these rods through the tarpon season, and what we have right now, we're working on the cosmetics. But we have a rod and a reel that is just basically going to change, you know, what saltwater fly fishing is all about regarding, you know, reels and rods. To give you a prime example of the reel, your typical reel, I've been with T-Bore for the last 20 years. The reel has got a big, large arbor, so you can take this reel offshore if you want. It's got carbon fiber discs, you know, so it's the same braking system as a Formula One race car. And you can apply, like a T-Bore reel's got maximum of 17 pounds of drag that you can use. We've got 35 pounds of drag. So if you want to fish outside of IGFA legal, you know, limitations, if you want to go try to catch a 500-pound blue marlin, you've got a reel that can apply some big pressure.
Wow, wow. Sounds interesting and exciting, yeah. And fun to be involved with, that's for sure. Well, let's jump back in here. One thing, going back to, you know, your success in the tournament that you didn't mention, and I know is an important part that we haven't really talked about yet, is your guide, who's ever on the back end of the boat. I'm sure that that makes a big difference in your success. And
well, you really absolutely have to be able, it's a team effort. And in the book, in the first one, to say, listen, I'm just one of many parts that make the success, that make the team. You've got to have boats. You've got to have motors that will see. With the base of the tournaments are in Isla Mirada. We run to Key West every day. So you've got an hour and a half to 2 hour boat ride going and coming. So you've got to get, you know, a flat skip that's going to go almost 60 miles an hour. And I really focused on getting guides that know a vast area. So they've got to be multidimensional too. I've got, as an angler, I've got to be able to catch fish not only in off-color water in the back, but I've got to be able to downsize and catch fish in swimming clear water, because you're not always going to be able to get what you want. So if I have a guide that knows the water from Miami to Key West, we can go anywhere and be successful. So Timmy Hoover is a guy that was mentored by Harry Spear. Timmy Hoover, right, I fished one bonefish tournament with Harry Spear and one tarpon tournament, and then I started fishing with Timmy Hoover because Harry retired from tournament fishing. But Hoover and I have won tournaments all the way from Isla Mirada to Key West. And then Doug Kilpatrick and then Paul Tejera. I won four golden flies with Paul Tejera. So you absolutely have to have, you know, a guide that knows, that's multidimensional as well as you are as an angler.
Yeah, yeah. We have a question from Gary Powell in Memphis, Tennessee, and he says, have you found any commonalities between tarpon fishing and your competitive snow skiing?
I think the commonality is the desire to win and the desire to break down the sports as they are. In downhill skiing, you have suits and poles and skis and waxes and bases, and then you have the technical and tactical aspects that you have to approach. And, you know, unfortunately, as a skier, I was not as professional as I should have been at that age. I didn't have the mentors. The U.S. ski team was very young in those years as far as being able to compete at a world-class level. But as a fly fisherman, I took those same skills and focus, but at a much higher level with the tarpon fishing. So it was reel design and rods and tackle and dropping down and fly design and tying flies and how we can change the sport, where can we find the fish, and working as a team with my guide to figure out, okay, we have very big, sensitive fish that do not want to be caught. And I've always felt that good fishermen can catch a lot of fish and a lot of big fish, but the best and the greatest fishermen can catch fish that don't want to be caught.
Yeah.
So we figured out how to catch those big fish that did not want to be caught. So the commonality is breaking the sport down and being able to put a number of pieces to the puzzle together. And the more pieces that you have in your repertoire, the better you're going to be.
We have a question that's come in on the Internet. Steve in Adirondacks, Northern New York. This is an interesting question. He said, if you could put your tarpon fishing skills into perspective for us, were you by comparison a better skier or a better tarpon fisherman?
I'm 10 times a better tarpon fisherman.
Interesting.
And like I said before, as a skier, I came into the sport and I started getting hurt at a very young age. I broke my leg at 12. I had knee operations at 16. A prime example, when I got to the starting gate at Val d'Isère, France, I can't remember what year it was, I looked over at Erwin Stricker from the Italian team, He had a helmet with a fairing. He had bent ski poles that wrapped around his body. And his downhill suit was all rubberized, coated. It looked like a condom. And here I had straight poles, a regular downhill helmet, and, you know, taking a look at that, we were sacrificing at least 2 to 3 seconds before we even left the starting gate to aerodynamics. So twofold. One, as an athlete, I was not training as hard. I was not focused as well as I should have been. And the technical aspect of the sport, we were way behind as a team. And obviously over the years, we've caught up. And like Bodie Miller now is who he has been and the success that he has attained is because the ski team has advanced in itself. But I, too, as an athlete, was well behind the eight ball. But as a tarpon fisherman, I was older, I was more refined, I was more focused, I was more professional, and I really feel that we really changed the sport over the last 20 years with the success I've had with my guides and the focus and concentration and the level of professionalism that we brought to the table.
So maturity is valuable, it sounds like. I found that to be the same in a lot of different ways. Question from Tom in Florida. What's the biggest tarpon you've caught on a fly?
Oh, gosh, you know, they get bigger the older we get. It's like the winds, you know. You know, I would say you never know exactly what they weigh until you put them on a scale, but I would say my biggest fish is between 160 and 170, but the greatest tarpon I caught, I think, not only are these tournament fish that you catch at the buzzer to win a big event like the Gold Cup, but my best fish I caught was an 82-pound, 4-ounce tarpon I caught on 6-pound test. And I was trying to break the longest-standing world record held by Stu Apt, which is 82.5 pounds. So I caught this fish on 6-pound test, and we missed the world record by 4 ounces. So that's probably the biggest quality fish that I've ever caught.
And tell me about the fish that Tom Evans just caught last week.
Well, Tom Evans is probably the greatest big fish fly fisherman of all time. He has been under the radar forever, but he has held, I think he's caught now maybe 7 or 8 world record tarpon. But then he's gone offshore, and he holds in striped black and blue marlin the 12 and 16-pound records. He's been chasing the 12-pound world record tarpon for about 15 years. And 3 weeks ago, he caught that fish. He just, and the tippet was just tested positive. I mean, it's a legal cat. It's a 194.5-pound tarpon on 12-pound test. And that fish is a fish he caught in an hour and a half. And I went to the IGFA to witness the testing of the tippet. And it was interesting in the fact that 12-pound test was all milked up, and it had been scraped by the scales of the fish for over an hour and a half. And that tippet broke at 9.4 and 8.7 pounds. So towards the end of that fight, had he applied more than 8.7 pounds of pressure, he would have broke that fish off. But I think, personally, that's probably the greatest fly fish caught ever.
And probably no one more deserving than him. And I say that after reading you do an interview with him and his guide Al, 20-page interview here in your book. And after reading that, he deserves it. He's earned it.
Well, here's a guy who talks about, you know, the pain. Homosassa was on a tarpon fly fishing at one point where you would go out and you wouldn't have to look for the fish. You look for the bus. So when you run the boat, you just start running and you see a big explosion. You go over there and start pulling and you will be among monster fish. The average size fish was 120 pounds. Ranging from 120 to, say, 250 pounds. And they would throw flies to these fish for 10 hours straight. And now, you know, because of the water quality and the lack of food, Tom has spent the last 15 years chasing a fish that is not there. And this year, too, I would talk to him almost daily. He would go for 5 days without even seeing a fish. And this year, he fished for 23 days and caught 4 fish. He caught a 120, 240-pound fish, in the 194.5. But you talk about a guy who knows how to pull on fish. He took his skills offshore and then started catching big marlin. But one of the interesting things that Tom has done over the years is that he's really tried to get inside the head of the fish. And it's interesting because in the book itself, it's his methodology of fighting big fish. And if you don't mind, I'll just read one quick paragraph.
Sure.
And he talks about how you can, you know, as long as you have his head, you're in control of the fish. And if the fish has his tail, he's in control of you. He talks about, and I'll quote here, and the higher you can keep him in the water, the better off you are. if you can back him up without doing stupid things like turn him over and all that blank stuff, that gets you all messed up. The next thing you can do is get his face out of the water. Then you see what goes on. You keep doing this. You try to mess with his head so he begins to think, I am a bait fish. I am not a real fish, and Jaws has got me. And this thing is the master, so I might as well give up. You cannot do that with a marlin because the marlin does not believe he's a bait fish. He believes he's a real fish.
Yeah, so I found that.
So this is interesting because here's a guy who has caught all these fish over the years, and he's taken it to a whole new level by trying to get inside the head of the fish.
Yeah, yeah.
And that you can only do that by catching a lot of fish and having a fish on the end of your rig, you know, for years and years and years.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what was his trophy 3 weeks ago? Was what, a 194.5?
He caught a 194.5 on 12-pound test tippet.
Wow, that's a big fish. That one picture, well, there's lots of pictures of big fish in here, but in your book on page 247 where Tom is, the fish is coming out of the water. And
it looks like a Polaris missile. I mean, here's
yeah,
a
200-pound
fish. Yeah, I think that's the greatest photograph ever taken of a tarpon fishing scenario. You've got a guide, Tom Evans, on the bow of his boat. He's bowing to a fish that is exceeds 200 pounds. It's 20 feet out in front of the boat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But what's interesting about this photograph and this fish is that they caught this fish, and Al takes the fly out of the fish's face. And then the fish jumps and hits Al in the face and lifts him up off the deck of his boat. When he drops back down, he drops the fish. The fish sinks in the water column and sinks down 8 feet. And they right the fish with a push pull and it swims off. I mean, the stories in this book about these guys and what they do with these fish is just absolutely incredible. You know, you're talking about Steve Hoff, probably the greatest flat skiff guide on the planet. I mean, he basically innovated the sport. He talks about gaffing fish. You know, in the early days of world records and the tarpon tournaments, they used to gaff these fish and kill them and bring them in and weigh them. And if you don't mind, I'll just read a quick paragraph about Huff. He talks about, the biggest rush I've ever had in my life is gaffing big tarpon. You reach out to this huge living thing lying beside the boat, and you have to really smash it and drive in that piece of half-inch stainless steel. It's razor sharp, smashing that thing into its back and having him go crashing away. And you're trying to stay in the boat. He says here, I got pulled over at least a half a dozen times trying to gaff a tarpon. They snatched me out of the boat and I'd go flying. And one time he talks about how he had his weight fish on, and he says, the thing goes out 100 yards or so and jumps a few times, and I'm trying to get the gap out and be ready when this thing comes next to the boat. He says the fish comes straight at the boat, pumping. And the fish has only been on the hook for maybe 3 minutes, and it jumps 3 times coming back to the boat and lands upside down next to the boat. And I'm standing there with the gaff in my hand. What are you going to do, right? He starts laughing. I told Sandy, just come get me. So here he goes. He reaches out, smashes this fish with the gaff, and all of a sudden he's ejected out of the boat, thrown overboard. It's 20 feet deep. And he says here, we're flying along the bottom. I'm holding on the end of the gaff handle, and all I can see in front of me is this fish's tail kicking, kicking, kicking. And I'm on the bottom, just hanging on. And I was actually hanging onto the gaff handle. He's got his face back, trying to keep his sunglasses on his face so he won't lose his sunglasses. You know, the stories go on and on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't get a story like that fishing for trout, that's for sure.
Well, you know, it brings fishing to a whole different dimension when you're catching something that can kill you.
That's right, that's right, that's right. That's something that can happen in the salt. Well, those are two great stories. Let's talk a little bit more about, we've got some questions. Chip in Colorado wants to know about learning the ropes of tarpon on a fly. Can he do this himself? Does he need a guide? You know, what does the newbie do?
Okay, I would say first and foremost, do not try to reinvent the wheel. And the knowledge that these guys bring to the table through the price of their guide's fee will save you years upon years of aggravation and frustration and money, too. You know, so I would say if you want to get into the sport, try to look ahead and call a reputable fly store like the Florida Keys Outfitters in Isla Mirada. Let them know, you know, what your aspirations are, when you can come down, how you can get a hold of a guide, and maybe, you know, fish, you know, like in July, August, or September, which a lot of people think is the off-season, but it's not. It's just really hot. But the fish are still there. You can go there and get, they can take you to where you can catch a number of baby tarpon. They're so easy, but they too are big. They're 30 to 50 pounds. And I would say, you know, try to get a hold of somebody and stick with that guide. And depending on, you know, what kind of monies you have available, maybe if you don't have the kind of monies it takes to get 2 or 3 days or 5 days by yourself, maybe share the bow with somebody. Share the expenses. But that's the best advice I can give, is to go with, I mean, if you want to learn how to ski, you don't try to do it on your own, you're going to get hurt.
I'm going to ask you, before I ask this question from Kenji in Australia, you've mentioned you fished in Florida for tarpon and also in Belize. Have you fished other places for tarpon?
I have not.
Okay.
You know, because Florida's my home, it's 2 hours away, and it's very accessible. After 25 years, I know everybody, and I've got my own boat, and I pull my son, so... You know, I just basically, you know, fish my home waters.
Okay, okay. Kenji in Australia, he says, you know, his dream is to come and fish for Atlantic tarpon. He wants to know the best place for overseas fishermen to come and land a giant tarpon. Would you say that's Florida?
Yeah, I would say Florida is the best because, you know, you have great accommodations. If you go elsewhere, it's still going to be expensive. But one of the things that Florida has that other countries don't have, we've got the greatest guides in the world, and their work ethic is second to none. You know, you go to certain camps, you've got to hang out with a lot of other people at night. It's a structure, it's a time schedule. But if you start fishing with the Florida Keys guides, it's you and the guide. If you want to fish early, then fish late. They are more than willing to work your hours. And a prime example is when I fish with my guides, we fish from 6 in the morning to 6:30 at night. We fish until you can't see. And there are a number of guides who are willing to do that. And on the average, they're willing to fish long hours. They're very knowledgeable, and they can get the job done. So I would just stick with Florida, whether it be Isla Mirada or Key West. Almost every guide out there is worth his salt.
My last experience down there was we got started very early in the morning before daylight. We're out on the water. But come around 3 o'clock, the guides were done. Is that normal, or is that...
Yeah, one of the things you may want to do is when you first, you know, contact a guide or a store, ask them if they have anybody who is willing to fish extra long hours. If you're willing to pay extra monies, these guys will, you know, stay out there longer. And like some of the guides may say, listen, we've got a morning tide that's not that good. Let's start a little bit later. We'll fish late. You know, so the schedule and the tides, you know, to what you all may want to do. Like my son and I, we fish from 4 in the morning to 9 o'clock at night. I mean, we've sometimes this year, on a number of days, we had 8 or 9 fish on before the sun even got up.
Yeah, yeah.
But that'll kill you. After three days,
typically,
in a coffin.
But typically your $500-$600 day rate should get you 8 hours of fishing?
Yeah, usually it's 8 hours, but like I said, a lot of guys are more than willing to fish longer hours. You know, if it's good fishing and you got a good tide and if you're willing to tip and, you know, and I've always said, you know, when you come to the table, you got to come with an attitude that you're willing to do what the guide wants to do, you say you're sorry, and you just work with the guy, and he's willing to work with you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we've got to take a quick break again, Andy, but we'll be right back, and lots more questions. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters, for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Andy Mill about a passion for tarpon. If you'd like to ask Andy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, these next few questions, Andy, I want you to try to move through them pretty quickly so we can get back to tactics and strategies and so forth, but I do want to get through these. Frank in Lanceville, British Columbia, asks about interviewing a guide. And he had an acquaintance that recently had a bad experience. Website looked good, but ... So
I would ask the guide, what are his hours? What kind of a schedule does he have? You know, how structured is he? How many years has he been there? Does he live there? Are these his home waters, or is he a transient? Does he just come down for the tarpon season?
Okay. And you want somebody that's living down there, I take it?
I want somebody who's there year-round.
Yeah, yeah. Frank also asked about, should one learn to fish by starting with the baby tarpon and then moving up to larger fish?
You know, you can do that, you know, because the baby tarpon are pretty agreeable, and they bite the fly every time they see it, so you can catch a pile of them, and you learn how to clear your fly line and learn how to throw the fly in there a little bit better. The bigger fish, you know, the learning curve is not quite as steep, but they're more rewarding in the long run. You know, but I'd say yes, you know, go ahead and fish that July, August time, you know, fish for some babies and then move to the big guys in April and May.
Okay, okay. Sean, in, he's from New York as well, he says he'll be down in Boca Raton at the end of June. Access to a small flat skiff. He's wondering if he can make a short trip from that area and find tarpon close to Boca Raton.
Boca Raton, the fish now are heading north after the worm hatches and the spawning. The migratory fish are now starting to slide north. So in Boca, you can find fish off the beaches there up by Jupiter. You know, you get out, wait for the sun to get kind of high, and they're going to be in probably 10 to 12 feet of water. And there'll be big schools, slowly rolling fish. And yeah, he can find fish up there that time of year.
Okay. Gordon Mann in Ocean City, New Jersey wants to know, where would be the best place to catch tarpon from a kayak?
I would say if you wanted to catch tarpon from a kayak, you've got a number of areas in the lower Keys that I like, you know, where he can row. He's got to be a little bit careful with the tides and whatnot. But I would say if he were to call some of the fly shops and talk to some of the guides, you know, down there, he can find some, you know, like around Pine Island, you know, by Sugarloaf area, you know, about 20-some miles north of Key West. I would do that. I would have him focus on some of the baby tarpon along the shorelines where he's not out, you know, in heavy current. You know, that would be my best suggestion, is to focus on the baby tarpon because they're in big schools and there are quite a few fish and they're pretty easy to catch.
Okay. Okay, let's talk about equipment here. A bunch of questions on equipment. Brian Whiting, who was on our show, and we interviewed him about fly fishing in Alaska. He's just down the road from you, Glenwood Springs. He says, would the 10-weight rod reel setup we use for king salmon on our trips to Alaska work for tarpon?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, though, when you start getting some stiffer winds, you know, if it's blowing out of the southeast, you know, 15 to 20, the tarpon bite the fly really good when the water gets a little bit chalked up and a little bit rougher. But that 10-weight, you might have a hard time casting as far as you need. And, you know, it's just not a big enough gun, if you will, if the conditions change. If it's slicked off and calm, there's no problem. I've caught fish over 100 pounds on 9-weights before. Actually, the 82-pound fish I caught on 6-pound test was a 9-weight rod. So, yes, that works, but I would have backup equipment in case the conditions change.
Well, I know a lot of the guides do have their equipment for you to use. That kind of goes to our next question, Frank, again from Lanceville, B.C. Says he has a 12-weight Sage XI-2 and Islander reels. He says, should he pack them and take them to Florida, or should he use what the guide has down there?
You know, if he's got to take it, you know, because I've refined my own stuff. You know, obviously I've done it at a very high level for a long time, but initially, when I first started tarpon fishing, I had my rods and my reels, and I took better care of my stuff than a lot of the guides have in their boat because they have all kinds of people using their equipment over a number of years, so the reels may be beat up, the drags might not be very good, the rods, you know, who knows what they have, and who knows, you know, with the level of professionalism of that guide. I mean, they're all professionals, but some guides take it, you know, and take it very personal, so their equipment is going to be pristine and perfect. But if they've got clients using their gear a lot, they're going to be pretty beat up. So I would say take your own stuff.
Okay. And Harry Spots, Chapel Hill, Tennessee, says, you are reputed to be the fastest ever to boat a tarpon. Please describe how you rig your leader from the fly line to the fly.
Okay. I use for my fly line, either a nail knot, like a 10-wrap nail knot with 60 pounds Seaguar fluorocarbon, and I use about 6 to 8 feet of that butt section, and then I drop it down with a blood knot to 40 pound, about 4 feet of that, so that's about 12 feet, and then I use a 16 pound mason, and my bimini twist on the top of my class section, I leave the legs in the top of the bimini, I cut that and twist my legs and attach that to my 40 pound butt with a blood knot, and then on the other end of the class, I use an improved blood knot to tie that to my shock. And my shock I use, depending on the fish I'm fishing for, will vary from, say, 70-pound Seaguar. And if it's very clear water, very sensitive fish, I'll drop down to, say, 30-pound, 40-pound Seaguar just to get the bite. Now, with the small 1-0 hooks and number 1 hooks I'm using now with the worm, a lot of times that hook will get set in the upper lip of that fish, so I can still catch a big fish with 30-pound shock. But usually if that hook is inside of its mouth, you're only going to get 2 or 3 jumps and the fish is going to fall off. So it kind of varies, but that basically are my knots and the length dimensions of the mono.
And so how long is your leader total?
My leader total is about 15 feet. You know, 15, 16 feet, sometimes a little bit longer. Now, you have to be a little bit of a different caster and proficient to turn that over into a wind. And if it's really windy, you're not going to be able to turn that over into a stiff breeze, so you got to cut that back a little bit.
Okay. Robert from Mobile, Alabama, asks about the gaff that you helped design, and he says it has a long handle, makes it easy to measure the girth and width.
The fish is not measured with the gaff, and I do not use, the only gaff I used was when I was trying to kill a world record fish. I've got, you know, an 8-foot gaff with a barb on it, and actually it's got some handles on it, and the lip gaff I use for the tournaments, I only was using that during the Gold Cup, you know, getting the fish into the boat, but I highly recommend not using gaffs. You put the hole in that fish's lower gill area or throat area, and these fish suck their food in, and so with that hole there, it's just not good. I'd much rather see somebody, you know, go ahead and grab that fish by the lower jaw with their hands, you know, with gloved hands. And to measure the fish, I've got like a 100-inch piece of cloth measuring tape. So if you get a hold of the fish, you measure the fish around, but where that dorsal fin is, there's a little hump there. Measure the girth, measure the length of the fish from that lower jaw tip to the fork of the tail, and then you take that measurement, and it's the girth squared times the length divided by 800, and you'll get the weight of that fish to about 5 pounds. And your previous question was, how do I catch these fish as fast as I do? Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, Roger, just to go back to that previous question, you have to know how much pressure you're applying to that hook or to that fish. And you will not do that just by bending the rod and pulling on fish. You need to have somebody attach that fly or the hook or attach the butt section of your fly line to a scale. Stand back, bend that rod, and have somebody call out the numbers that are representing the weight of resistance. And you will not catch fish quickly unless you can learn to apply 12 to 14 pounds of pressure on that fish. And then if you can walk that fine line, you catch that fish, let him jump, let him get all that green energy out of that system, and then have your guide get you up to the fat section of your fly line and start applying 13 to 14 pounds of pressure on that fish and keep it there, that fish is going to be belly up in 10 to 15 minutes maximum. And I'm talking about 120-pound fish as well. And the best way to learn, I do this with my son, is I tell my son, okay, you got a fish on. You got 5 minutes. If that fish is not in my hands in 5 minutes, I get a pull on him. So then that way, he wants to catch that fish because he doesn't want to have to give up that rod. Now you learn how to catch that fish because you got something at stake. You know, you're going to have to hand that rod over to somebody else if you don't get to catch him in 5 minutes.
Now, you, we had talked about this earlier before the show, and I had seen a video clip. I can't remember. I don't know if it was a Chasing Silver or where there's a video clip of you pulling on a bucket that was
right.
12-pound
well,
bucket or something.
Yeah, what I did as a tournament fisherman, I knew I wanted to catch these big fish quickly. So what I did is I had my ex-wife holding a scale, and I attached the butt of my fly line to a scale, and she would read off the numbers of pressure, and it was like 7, 8, 9 pounds. And I was trying to get to 12, 13, 14, and it is a true eye-opener. So to eliminate the pain of somebody else trying to help you, what I did is I put a pulley system under my workbench and filled a bucket with 14 pounds of dirt. I attached a piece of monofilament from the handle of the bucket through the pulley system, and just before I attached it to the butt of my fly line, I would measure or I'd weigh with my scale how much that bucket weighed. So when I got it to 14 pounds, I attached that to the butt section with a blood knot, and then when I stood back and held onto my fly line, I knew now when I picked up that bucket, when that bucket came up off that floor when I was pulling the butt section of my fly rod, I knew I had 14 pounds of pressure. And I would stand there for hours pulling on that bucket. and that created muscle memory in my hands. And you'll notice right away that if you do not pull correctly with the fly rod with 14 pounds of pressure, you will break the rod tip. If you reach up with your hand to the first stripping guide and try to pull from there, you'll break your rod. You have to have your hands on the cork, and you bend the rod from back by the handle, back by the cork, because the midsection of the rod and the tip of the rod is not capable of lifting or pulling 14 pounds of pressure. And that's the only way you can learn how to apply a lot of pressure to a fish, is to be able, is to pull on a scale. Have somebody, you know, attach something to a scale and pull.
But what is the angle of your rod to get the best?
It's relatively straight. Yeah, it's relatively straight to the fish, because two things. If you have a big bend, you can apply a relatively large bend in your rod, but when you apply 13, 14 pounds of pressure to that fish with a big bend, that puts more pressure on your arms. Anatomically, it's so hard. How many curls can you do with 14 pounds of pressure? With a 14-pound barbell, okay? Mm-hmm. But now, if you kind of straighten your elbows and straighten that rod so the pressure goes to the butt of the rod, now, anatomically, your body is in a line. The rod is working for you because you're using the beefiest part of the rod to fight that fish. Now, one thing to remember is the more bend you have in the rod, the more room for air you have. So if you've got a bigger bend in the rod, which I use when I fish with light tippets, like 6 and 8 pound test tippets, I use a little bit more of a bend in the rod because there's a little bit more room for air because of the absorbing ability of the rod. But with that straighter rod, you can really catch these fish quickly. It's just that you have to be a little bit careful, and you've got to have kind of loose knees and elbows, because if the fish surges, if you can give and become a part of the absorbing ability of that rod, a human sponge, if you will, you're going to be able to get away with some mistakes.
Okay, we need to take a quick break, but I'll be right back, and we've got lots more to talk about, so hang tight. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you can sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051, or visit his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Andy Mill about a passion for tarpon. If you'd like to ask Andy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, other questions. A follow-up on the pressure. So I take it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most people are not applying enough pressure and not correctly in most circumstances, which means they have to fight the fish longer. Is that correct?
They have no idea how much they're pulling. If you see your typical tarpon guy with a big bent rod and he's got sweat pouring down his forehead and he's out there for an hour and a half, he may have 4 or 5 pounds of pressure on that rod or on that fish. And if you just go out in your backyard and you grab that rod, and you have your wife, you know, hang onto a scale, and you attach that, you know, the monofilament or a hook to a scale, and without her even saying anything, you just bend as hard as you can. You pull, you bend that rod as much as you possibly can, and you guess in your head how much weight you think you have that you're applying. And I would venture to say nobody's pulling more than maybe 9, possibly 10 pounds of pressure.
Wow.
It's just because they've never measured the resistance. They've never taken a closer look at how much resistance they're applying to the fish.
My son, last time we were down, he caught what the guide estimated to be about 120-pound tarpon, and it took him, I think, 24 minutes to bring the fish to the boat.
That's fast. That's very good.
Oh, that was? Yeah, he was dying.
No, that's good, you know, because you have to remember that not all fish are the same. You can hook an 80-pound fish, and he's just going to just never give up. Mm-hmm. And you might catch a 150-pound fish that flops 3 times, never leaves the fly line, and goes belly up in 4 minutes. You know, so it's not only applying pressure, but the beast that you're attached to, they, too, have different spirit.
So he did pretty good for his first time.
He did great, yeah. 120-pound fish, in 20-some minutes, I think that's very admirable.
Good, good. Question from Raul in Campeche, Mexico. Raul, I know a guy down there for the small baby tarpon. He asks about color of tarpon flies. How important is it for them to match the real diet of the big fish?
Well, you know, I don't think a lot of these flies, a lot of times necessarily have to be perfect imitations of crabs and shrimp and bait fish. I think as I went back to that whole analogy of a cat and a yarn scenario, where if you get a fly in the right spot and twitch it and bump it and shake it and tweak it, that fish, even though he may not be hungry, will bite that fly just to get it out of his face. Mm-hmm. But with that said, if you have, like, early morning and later in the evening, dark conditions, I love a black fly, like the peanut butter fly from the Puglisi fly. That dark purple and black fly is awesome. You know, if you're fishing early in the morning, the sun's not even up yet. You know, that's the go-to fly. But other than that, when I'm on the flats fishing for sensitive fish, tarpon and a lot of fish love chartreuse. Now, I don't know why, but I know needlefish and certain bait fish have green, you know, in their coloration. I use a lot of light brown shrimp imitations. So I think it means a lot, but I think more than color of your fly, it's the presentation, where that fly is in relationship to the fish, and how you entice that fish to bite your fly. Because if it's not perfect, you can still get a fish to bite it.
Okay, okay. So positioning of the fly and action of the fly are, in your mind, more
imperative
than the...
Yeah.
Joseph in Slickerville, New Jersey, and this goes to something you were talking about earlier. He says he's noticed there's been a movement to smaller flies. He wants to know if you throw the big patterns you used to in the past, or do you stick with the smaller?
They're getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, not only are the hooks getting smaller, but the shock tip, like I said, I mean, I've gone from, you know, 80-pound when I first started fishing down to standard now is 60 and 70. If the water is slightly off color, you can get away with fishing a heavier shock. Like if you're fishing in the mud in Florida Bay behind Isla Mirada, you can go to like an 80-pound, and there's no problem. But if you're fishing clear water sensitive fish, you may have to drop down to number one hooks, little worm imitations with 30, 40, and 50-pound shocks, you know, and a lot of guys now are using the monoc fly line where it's the entire fly line is clear. So I think to be successful in this day and age, absolutely, your tackle has got to be downsized.
Lane in Anna Maria, Florida asks about fishing in gin clear coastal waters of Florida. What's your favorite fly pattern? Clear water and colors.
Well, I have gravitated. I've got tree bane patterns. I've got, you know, the taste toad or toad, as most people know it, has been my fly for the last 20 years. I've won so many, you know, most of my tournaments fishing the toad, but I've also designed a little brown shrimp fly that I throw, as well as a palola worm imitation. So those are my three patterns I use, and I use all those patterns in a number one or a 1-0 hook. But the most important thing is not only the fly. You know, a lot of people focus on what's the fly. Focus on where you put that fly, how you intercept that fish, and how you feed that fish. Those aspects of tarpon fishing are more important than the fly. But you've got to have, to start with, you've got to have a fly on that's not going to be offensive to the fish. You can't be throwing 5-0 hooks anymore. You've got to have the, you know, a small fly and a very soft tide fly, that is not offensive.
Let's talk about that presentation here for a few minutes. Jay Wright in Windermere, Florida, says, first of all, I get conflicting advice from good tarpon anglers and guides on which fish to initially throw in a long string. If you are not trying to single out a larger fish and have a good angle on the lead fish, do you always throw to the lead fish? Are there times when you should throw further back in the string?
I never, unless that string of fish is coming directly at me at my 12 o'clock position and that's the only shot I have, I never throw to that lead fish. That lead fish is the leader of the pack, and for some reason, you know, they're a leader for a reason. And they duck flies, and when they duck, they turn left or right, and they duck their head, and they swim deeper, and they turn. They will pull that entire school. And for some reason, once that lead fish ducks your fly, the rest of the fish know that there's something bad up. You know, so what I would say is try to get off to the side of the string and then I would put my fly in the back of the fish that's leaving the fish that you want to feed. Always use the fish as camouflage. So I'll throw my fly over the back of, say, maybe the second or the third fish trying to feed the following fish. And a lot of people will do that, but they start stripping too soon. Make sure when you make your move, when you strip that fly, it's a movement of purpose. And a lot of people know that they may be nervous, and they're supposed to throw the fly and start stripping. Think of the analogy, I'm trying to feed an animal. That fly is there for a reason. I want to make it move the correct and proper way to entice that following fish to bite my fly. But I would suggest, you know, that the guy try to get you off to the side just a hair so you can feed the rest of the fish in the school.
Okay. He was talking about a string, so I'm assuming he's talking about one following the other when he talks about...
Exactly right. No, that's
rather
exactly
than
right.
A school formation.
I understand what he's talking about. You may have three or four or five or six fish following each other. Sometimes the string will be longer. But the other thing you have to be considerate of is that if you're trying to catch the second fish and if the angle is not right, if it's a 90-degree angle, skip the first two or three or four fish and aim for the fish that is further back in the string, so your angle to the fish is going to be better.
Because
a lot of fish don't like that fly moving at a 90-degree angle. They want it moving directly away from the fish. So think about the angle, and that fish that's following well back in the pack may have his guard down, and that's going to be an easier fish to catch.
And you'd use the word earlier, intercept the fish rather than throw out.
Right. So what you do is when you slide that fly in there, and you put that fly over the back of, say, maybe the third fish or the fourth fish, you know, you want to move that fly in perfect alignment of the fish that's following the fish that you put the fly over. You leave the fly there just for a hair. Let that fish clear, and then just start baby bumping. You want as much movement as you can get with that fly without moving the fly. Because if you strip that fly out of position, that fish does not necessarily want to leave that string. He does not want to lead that fish he's following to eat your fly. So if you can leave that fly in position, so all that fish has to do is open its mouth, he's going to do that a lot sooner and more often than he is going to be willing to peel out of that line to come eat your fly.
I can see how important the angle is for something
absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. That...
You can't do it at 90 degrees, basically. I mean, a few inches, you could move the fly, and then you're out of the line.
You're out of the game. Yeah, right. And also you're pulling that fish out of that line, and
right.
A lot of fish don't want to do that.
Now, would you have the same approach if you had a school where they're not moving in line, but more of a pod situation?
Are you talking about a daisy chain of fish?
No, I was talking about where
they're flying
in a quadrant more than a line.
A big ball of fish you're talking about?
Yeah, where you've got a lead fish, two flanking it, maybe three or four behind that.
Well, you know, if I've got, you know, fish coming at me and they're kind of spread across, I always pick a fish I want to fish to. And an interesting note here is that if you can find a fish that's browner in coloration, let's just say hypothetically you've got a lead fish, two fish on its right, and the outside fish is brown in color, or the inside fish is brown. I try to fish that brown fish, and I don't know why, because it's not documented, I don't know how we can ever do it, but I have found that a fish that is high in brown, the adage goes, if they're high in brown, they suck it down. They just bite so much better than the black-backed fish.
Hmm.
And I don't know if it's because they've been offshore spawning, and their energy is low, and they're looking for food, and that shows up in the coloration of their back, but I always try to target that browner fish.
Now, you'd mentioned the daisy chain. What's the tactic there?
Well, the tactic is to throw the fly to the side of the fish that is swimming toward you. Obviously, you don't want to throw the fly to a fish that's going away. That, and I try not to throw into the middle of the chain. I try to feed the outer-edged fish because two things. One, if you throw into the meat, you may take a chance of spooking a fish with your fly line. And that outer spinning fish, you may have a better angle to that fish. So I always try to fish the outer edge of a daisy chain.
So the secret seems to be wherever or however the fish are is to get the best line so that you're pulling the fly. You don't scare the fish, but you're close enough to be pulling that fly away from the fish in a natural fashion.
Right.
And preferably directly in front of them, which is going to be hard to do, but trying to do your best to simulate.
Right, and your guide will try to position the boat so that once you make that cast, the fly is moving directly away from the fish. But, you know, if you've got a string of fish, you don't want that because then that means you got to throw it to that lead fish.
Yeah,
you know,
so a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I try to keep off to the side just a hair if it's a string, but if it's a ball coming straight at you, you know, I always try to look and pick out one particular fish and feed that fish.
Okay, question from Christian in Santiago, Chile, asks, can you describe what technique that gives you the better result as far as setting the hook? And I've heard a lot about setting the hook, so...
Okay, this is very important. Most people, if they're not experienced, when they see that tarpon open its mouth, they trout strike. They set the hook. They're so nervous and so anxious, and all of a sudden, they've had a number of shots, and all of a sudden that tarpon eats his fly, and there's this huge mouth opening. The key to being really good at this is you do not set the hook until you feel the weight in your stripping hand. So you're basically hand-lining that fish. Once that fish opens its mouth and eats your fly, just try to keep your cool and just keep stripping. Because that fish is going to eat your fly, it's going to shut its mouth, and it's going to turn, and it takes a long time for that fish to do that. And if you try to strip too fast or go to your rod too early, you're going to slide that fly right out of its mouth. So I would say, if anything, just try to slow down. Okay? And if you're a right-handed caster stripping with your left hand, when you feel the weight of the fish in your left hand, at that point you hang on and jab that hand back with your fly line in it. Hang on and then go to your rod. Because now when you go to your rod, with the weight of the fish already on the string, that rod is going to bend back by the handle. If you set the hook way too early, you'd be setting the hook with the tip of the rod. And the rod does not have as much resistance with the tip. So what's going to happen if you set the hook with the tip, the hook is just going to point and poke that fish, and as soon as he sticks his head out of the water, the fly is going to come flying out of his mouth. So the most important thing you can do is try to slow down, keep stripping, and when you feel the weight of the fish in your stripping hand, hang on, set that hook by stripping back with that stripping hand, and then go to the rod last. And what I'll do is with that rod, I'll just seat that hook like three jabs with the rod, and with the hand, obviously the weight of the fish in your hand, that hook's going to go to the bend. You don't have to worry about sticking him 5, 6, 7, 10 times. That's all stupid shit. I mean, they're going to fall off the hook. Just get the weight of the fish and just seat the hook with the rod, and you're going to get him.
Okay. Now, he's hooked up. What tips can you give us on fighting the fish?
Well, as soon as you get that fish hooked, just look down and make sure you clear your fly line and get him on the reel. Okay? And once you get him on the reel, now you're just having fun. You know, just watch the fish go flying through the air, and if he jumps, I do not fish with a very tight drag. The drag I have on my reel is maybe 3 pounds. And when that fish jumps early in the fight, when he's really energetic and powerful, I bow to the fish. But I always try to keep a little bit of pressure on my rod tip because that will keep the hook, you know, in the fish's face. Late in the fight, if that fish jumps and you bow completely and throw total slack, that hook can fall out of the hole. So later in the fight,
yeah, it's
I will
bow.
It's
gotten bigger, right? Yeah.
It could possibly have gotten bigger if it's later in the fight. So what I'll do is when that fish jumps late in the fight, I'll just give him my rod a little bit, but I keep pressure on the rod tip. But I don't try to do much early in the fight. When that fish is going ballistic, I just hang on, let him do his thing, you know, and then just start gathering your backing and your fly line. Have your guy get you up to the fat part of the fly line, which is maybe 20 feet away from the fish, 20 to 30 feet away from the fish. And once you get the fatter part of your fly line, now you got something to hang on to. And one of the things that I notice when I watch fishing shows, anybody who ever lets go of his fly line tells me right then he's not an experienced angler. The only time I don't have contact with my fly line is when the fish is running hard. Because when I cast my fly, I always have control and contact with the fly line, even if I'm making a long cast. Because once you make that cast, you need to have control of that hook and fly. If you're fishing to blitzing fish, you know, bonita or whatever, that bite's going to happen right away. If you've got to throw to a fly and you cast a little bit close to a tarpon and you've got to slide that fly into position, if you let go of the fly line, you got to relocate and get reconnected to move that fly. Now, when you're flying the fish, I apply pressure by having the fly line in my hand. I hang onto my fly line to apply pressure because I'm not going to have 14 pounds of drag on my fly reel. So when that fish surges, and when I got a hold of that fish and I'm trying to back him up and fight him, I just release the fly line in my fingers and let him slide forward. And then once that fish is done surging, I just reapply the pressure on the fly line and back him up. And the only, and even if the fish is 300 yards away and you're reeling in all that backing, my little finger is connected to the backing, and I'm using my little finger as a line winder as I'm collecting all that line. Otherwise, it's going to get piled up on your reel. So the only time you don't have contact with the fly line is when that fish is flying through the air, you know, running away from you.
So you're providing most of the pressure just with your hand on the line and not using the drag on the reel.
I never rely on my drag because it's too light.
Okay.
I fight all my fish with the fly line in my hands, you know, and whether it's be interwound through my fingers or I've got pressure against the fly line against the cork, I've got control of that fish with the fly line in my hand. But you've got to be a little bit careful because if you're hanging on to that fly line and that fish surges and you got 20-pound test and you don't let go, you know, like that shark skin line, that could cut you. So this is kind of a learning curve and learning how to fight fish with the fly line in your hands. And if I'm catching a lot of fish, I'll put like a narrow half-inch of adhesive tape around, you know, my knuckle or joint of my fingers where that fly line could cut me just for added protection.
Yeah,
but the best fly fishermen in the world never lose control of their fly line.
Okay, good note. One last thing here, and then we got to close things off. Okay, you've done all that correct. You've got them to the boat. Nowadays, like you said earlier, unless it was a tournament, you had to kill the fish, basically, to weigh it. Nowadays, what's the proper procedure, you know, to say you've landed the fish officially? What are the requirements, and do you pull them in the boat anymore? Do you leave them in the water? What's the problem?
Well, if you're fishing in the tournaments and it's a weight fish tournament like a Gold Cup, you've got to take a photograph of the fish. You have to measure the girth of the fish and the length of the fish, write that down, and then the girth of the fish is measured by a tie strap. You put a tie strap around that fish and snug it tight. Take a photograph of the fish, measure the length of the fish from the lower jaw to the fork of the tail. And then the weighmaster back at the dock will measure that tie strap for the girth of the fish, and he'll do the calculation, girth squared times the length divided by 800. When you're fun fishing, a lot of the anglers will get the nail knot into the top of the rod and then just straighten the rod and break the fish off. That way the fish does not have a whole lot of lactic acid buildup. He's going to be released in a better state to avoid the sharks, etc. My personal opinion, I like catching them. I like getting my hands on their face. I like taking the fly out of their face. But I don't advise that for people that are going to take an hour to catch that fish, because if you do so, that's basically a dead fish. He's going to be so exhausted, he won't be able to avoid the sharks. And you have to remember, I'm catching my fish between 5 and 15 minutes, so that fish is going to be released with a lot of energy still.
Now, what about to get a picture? What's the best way to get a good picture?
The best way to get a picture is once that fish is floated, you slide him over to the side of the boat, have your guide grab a hold of his lower jaw, you know, and have a camera ready prior. So if you hook a fish, have the guide get the camera out, or you as an angler get the camera ready before you even hook up, just have it there so the guide has easy access to it. And then, once you catch that fish, have your guide grab a hold of the fish, keep his face in the water. Have him take the fly out of the fish, okay? Because if you're going to go to grab the fish, the fly is still attached, the guide loses the control of the fish, he can swim off with your fly rod. So have the guide grab a hold of the lower jaw of the fish, take the fly out, then you jump down, grab a hold of the fish, the guide can grab the camera and take a picture of it. What you can do is just pull it up to maybe, you know, the midsection of the fish, down light, and have the guide take a couple quick pictures, and then make sure you resuscitate the fish before you let him go, and it's a done deal.
Yeah, and one thing the guides told me down there, tell me if you agree with this, is that they found nowadays as if you actually pull the fish inside the boat that you take a chance on ruining their internal organs, damaging their internal organs.
Yeah, there's all kinds of issues. And I think any fish that's pulled into the boat now after all the years I've been doing, I think, especially if it's a fish that's been on the hook for an hour or so, it's a dead fish.
Okay.
You know, and also, legally, you can no longer do that. If you take a fish into your boat, you have to have a $50 tarpon tag that has been previously purchased by the guide or yourself, and that tag has to be installed in the lower jaw of the fish before you can bring him into the boat. Otherwise, you can be fined.
So they're saying, you bring it in the boat, you killed it, it's your fish now. You just paid for it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's illegal unless you have a tag to do that.
Yeah.
I caught a fish with former President Bush, 41, the elder President Bush, about 3 years ago, and came to me. It was on his bucket list to catch a big tarpon. And I took him out. We caught a big fish, about 140-pound fish. And I knew that if I got him a big fish, I wanted to pull that fish into the boat, put it on the president's lap, and take a photograph of that fish, because if anybody deserved to catch a big fish and have a photograph taken with it, it's former President Bush. I mean, he has been such a great conservationist for this country. And as a passionate angler, I wanted that photograph for him. So I got a tag. I put it in the fish, we pulled in the boat, we had that fish out of the water maybe 15 seconds, put him back in the water, resuscitated him, and he swam off. And I've never seen an 80-year-old man with such a big smile on his face.
Well, with that nice ending, we got to cut it off here, Andy, but we've got to wrap things up, and we're way past time, but stick with me because we're going to give away your book and posters and a bunch of stuff here in the last few minutes. So,
thank you, Roger, and make sure people go to Wild River Press to find the book.
Oh, yeah. We'll direct
giving
them
away
shortly. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners from the drawings are randomly selected from our database, so you had to pre-register for that. It's too late now, but make sure you do so in the future because we're always giving away some great things. So the first thing we're giving away today is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And our winner there is Martin Coleman. Martin Coleman from Kansas. So, Martin, congratulations. And we'll send you the information on getting that membership or extending one if you already have one. For others that want to know more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. Fedflyfishers.org. Now, the second giveaway for our drawing is to the Fly Fusion magazine, which you can learn more about at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Quinton Donnelly from New Zealand. So, Quinton, congratulations. That's a long way, a ways from where we are, but congratulations, and we'll get that subscription started for you. Now, our drawing for Andy's book, A Passion for Tarpon. And by the way, this book, as Andy said before, is available from Wild River Press. Go to wildriverpress.com. If you don't win the book tonight, you'll need to order one. And you can only order it from there. You can't get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or places like that. You need to order it from the publisher. It's just been published. I think they're going to be delivered the first week or so in July. So keep that in mind, and if you're interested in that or any of these posters that were taken from the book, then you can get those at Wild River Press as well. Okay, so let me clear my queue here. And to win this book, you're going to have to go to our homepage and put the answer to the question in there. And I'm going to require several answers to get this book because this is a gorgeous book, 500-page book, 8.5 by 11, color photography, I mean, it's quite the prize to win. So listen very carefully. Listen very carefully. I want to know the top three flies that Andy recommended that he uses most often, the top three flies, I need the names of those, and the most common length of his leader. Okay? Top three flies and the most common length of his leader setup once he's finished tying it up. So you do that, you win the book. Somebody didn't wait till I finished. So 194.5 on 12-pound tippet, is that the answer, Andy?
That's the answer for the new world record on 12.
Yeah.
But not for the question we just asked.
Yeah. He was a little premature on that one, huh? Okay, here's another one that says, gave me the leader, but doesn't give me the three flies. So I'm going to have to pass on that one, too. Here's one that gives me just one of the flies. I want to make this a little bit different. Okay, I don't think this one's right, but I'm going to check it with you, Andy. He says, toad, worm, shrimp, and 24-foot.
Well, the 24-foot actually includes the 9-foot ghost tip, you know, with the 15-foot leader. So, you know, the leader itself is 15 feet, but that's pretty darn close.
So would you, you're the one that has to decide, so you want to accept that one?
Well, if somebody behind that has 15-foot leader in the three flies, they actually are more technically correct because the leader is about 15 feet.
Well, let me look at the next one. And the next one is toad, brown shrimp, koala, worm, and 15 feet.
That wins.
Yeah, that's spot on. He even gave me more detail than I wanted. So.
Right.
So the winner is Travis Daly in Cookeville, Tennessee. You just got yourself a gorgeous book, buddy, and I know you're going to enjoy it. Send me your name, address, phone number, email address, and you can put it right in the same box you just answered the question in, and or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. Ask info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll have Tom over at Wild River Press send that out to you. Okay, now we've got some posters, so you guys still have some chances to win. Let me clear my queue here. So the first poster I'm going to give out is a Leaping Tarpon poster, and I want to know what the gentleman's name is that just caught that world record 3 weeks ago. Who is that gentleman's name? We're still getting answers from the last question here. Trying to clear the queue here. Okay. We've got Tom Evans. Sounds good to me. How about you?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so Sean, and what we'll do is if we'll take the, and it's one, Tom Evans, yeah, and Sean Towers won that in Albany, New York. So Sean, send me your email address and physical address and so forth, just like I asked before. Use the same text box or info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And we'll get that poster off to you. And I'm going to take, just for time purposes here, I'm going to take the next right answer and give the second poster, which is Tarpon Fever, out. And that's going to go to Mark Hayes in Orlando. So Mark Hayes in Orlando. The next poster, and that's going to be Tarpon Fever, the next poster is Swimming Tarpon. And for that, Andy told a story about a guy with a gaff that went scuba diving with the gaff, basically, or free diving, let's say that. What was that gentleman's name? What was that gentleman's name for a poster here? And I've got Mike Restivio in St. Charles, Illinois, said Steve Huff.
Perfect.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, these guys were paying attention tonight, Andy.
They were.
Yeah. So, Mike, same thing. Send me your contact information, and we'll get you that poster. And then our final poster here goes to anyone that can tell me what was the most important thing for getting the hook set. What do people need to do, more often than not, to get that hook set? What do they need to do? Okay. Anyone want to answer that one? Anybody know? What do they need to do? Keep stripping? That's not what we were looking for, I don't think. Was it, Andy?
Well, you want me to tell you?
Well, no, because then they'll type it in. Let the fish come tight. I'm just
That's
reading it. Them off to you.
Yeah. I mean, you wait till you feel the weight of the fish. But that answer is actually correct. You know, wait till it gets tight.
Okay. Wait till it gets tight. That's what people need to do, is wait and... I just lost that. Okay, we will check that out. I'm trying to find, I don't think we had a name with that one, so. Okay, yeah, here's what we, slow down and feel the weight. And I think
right.
That's what we were looking at.
Yeah.
And then this is John Julifs, it looks like, Julifs. So John, send us your information and we'll get you that Tarpon Dreams poster. So, good job, listeners, and thanks for playing tonight, and I know you're going to enjoy your prizes, so enjoying. Congratulations. Well, Andy, we went long, but it was well worth it tonight, and I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. I just hope everybody enjoys their tarpon fishing, and a lot of success to you all out there. And I know that if they have a chance to buy this book, it really is a phenomenal book, and they'll have it. They'll cherish it for a long, long time.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for writing it and putting it all together.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you to all the listeners out there.
Our next broadcast will be on July 7th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we'll interview Dusty Wismith. And our topic for the show will be improving your casting fundamentals to catch more fish. Dusty is a Federation of Fly Fishers certified casting instructor and will go over the fundamentals of casting that are so important to catching more fish. If you're struggling with casting problem, here's your chance to ask a question of one of the best casting instructors around. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Keeney's Fly Shop, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.